We are now recording, and I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through the deck for tonight.
Okay, well, we've got quite a mixed bag of things tonight. I hope everybody finds it interesting, so welcome everybody. First of all, just a quick note to remind you that the board is looking at possibly doing a series of Zoom video conferences looking at specific issues. And if you go to this web page, you can see what the choices are. You can give us your suggestions, and you can also vote for a day and a time. So that, just go to the opcug.ca website, and you'll find the link for the technical solutions page. All right, we're starting off the real deck with a couple of shares, I think, and the first one is for Chris.
Yeah, I just came across this a couple of days ago. Naked Security, it's a blog that is run by Sophos, a security company out of the UK. And they had a pretty neat little video, I think, that they put together pretty well, SMS scams and what to watch for and how to avoid getting your computer compromised, your privacy, or whatever. I'll paste that URL into the chat window for anybody who's interested, or you can pick it up later on with the PDF deck that will be posted on our website. But I just thought it was fairly well done. I think it was about a 15-minute video talking about SMS scams. So that's texting scams and why they are a little bit unique in what they try to do.
Okay, and then people who were on the conference initially heard a lot about Windows drivers or Windows Update providing drivers. If you're a club member and you've been on the members only forum, you will have seen quite a bit of chat about it. But again, this is a thing which Chris started off, so I'll let him talk about it.
Okay, I happened across it just on one of the forums that I frequent, where they talked about people all of a sudden, actually it was in the Windows Insider forum, and they talked about all of a sudden people were reporting getting optional updates offered to them that were inappropriate for the computer they were on. And I checked on mine, and sure enough, I had all kinds that were inappropriate for the computer that I was on at the time, including one going back to 1970. We have some from 2017 and things like that. The long and short of it seems to be that you should avoid any optional driver updates that are offered at this point in time. I just checked 5 minutes ago, and I'm still being offered a list of inappropriate drivers. They are all under optional, and so I suggest that you avoid them at this point in time. No word out from Microsoft as to why it's happened, when it'll be fixed, and other tech forums that I've seen, the best that I've been able to come up with so far is, yes, there's a problem, and avoid optional driver updates.
Brilliant. Okay, so on to the first real question. I think this was Karen, who can't be with us tonight, unfortunately, so you have to follow along with the bouncing ball, Karen. Karen has a Microsoft Livecam. It's a webcam, and had software that let her do pan and zoom and change the resolutions and that kind of thing. But that software, that the control software, seems to have disappeared from her computer, and she can't find it available from Microsoft. It turns out that there is a web page, a Microsoft web page, which offers drivers for this particular webcam. And at the bottom, there's some Windows 7 software, which I'd suggested that might actually work on Windows 10, because normally Windows 7 stuff runs quite well on Windows 10. Anyway, I think Chris followed up on that and has some thoughts.
Yeah, so I had remoted to Karen's computer, and we were looking at a number of problems, including this one. And so we tried installing the software. It installed fine, although it ended up saying that it wanted to install Windows Live Essentials as well, which I think are defunct now, but I'm not even sure. But afterwards, we ran the software. It actually ran fine, but it couldn't find any camera. So you just had a black screen and, of course, couldn't do any controls because it didn't think there was a camera there. I decided, well, we'll try compatibility modes. If you right-click on a program and you go to properties, there's a compatibility tab. And I said, well, this came out in the era of Windows 7, so let's set up compatibility mode to Windows 7. Didn't help at all. Did some online search and found there were a number of people who were reporting the same problem that with Windows 10, it seemed to have been, it came about at 1703 feature update, it actually got removed, the LifeCam software got removed automatically by Microsoft. So I guess they figured there was a compatibility issue that they were not willing to fix. And I do say that it's not willing as opposed to can't. It's their hardware, their software, and their operating system. So they could have made it work if they really wanted to, I believe. So the camera did function. We checked it under Skype, so we knew it wasn't a problem with the camera actually not showing up in Windows. It does show up, but just the LifeCam software does not see the camera at all, so therefore you don't have any of that more control over the camera. I don't think it's ever going to actually be fixed. This slide, I do believe it's unconscionable for Microsoft, the way that they abandon their own hardware and their customers. And I really do believe that it's not a case of that they couldn't fix it. It's that they chose not to fix it. Now, it is an old camera. It came out 14 years ago. But I don't think that's necessarily any reason to abandon your customers. But having said that, I don't think it's going to get fixed.
Well, you're right, Chris. I mean, they have a history of abandoning hardware. The phone, I think, was the most recent thing that went away.
Yeah.
So I think they lost a media player a number of years ago, too.
Yeah. They've given up on sound cards. They've given up on, to me, it's a terrible business practice that they seem to carry on with. But I don't think that any voice is going to change that.
Okay, so the next question is, what is the dark web? Do I need to be concerned, and how do I avoid it, essentially? And I think Chris has some thoughts on this one, too.
Yeah, I did a little bit of research on it. I don't do anything on the dark web, but I just thought I'd read up a little bit to see if I could find out a little bit more than what I already knew. The dark web is really just an internet. So the internet is basically a network of networks. And so this is just another internet. It uses all the same standard protocols that you find on the normal internet, but you can't access it through normal means. It'll take either special search engines to find it or different web browsers such as the Tor browser, things like that in order to actually be able to access it. So it is often blamed for, or it's one of its characteristics, I guess, is that it's used for illicit activities such as selling drugs or guns or various things like that. And true, there is an awful lot of illicit activity goes on there because it makes anonymous behavior a lot easier. But it is also used for legitimate purposes. So the Tor browser is an anonymizing browser. And so you'll find that people or organizations that require an anonymity, such as in repressive regimes, or even just it could be people worried about talking about mental health, that it could affect their insurance and things like that. So there are non-illegal activities that the dark web is actually used for as well. I think in the context of how this was originally asked about, I don't think anybody has to worry about accidentally stumbling onto the dark web and coming into contact with some of this illegal activity or finding that just some place that you went to, now law enforcement is interested in you. It's not going to happen. So unless you actually really go about trying to access to the dark web, you're not going to accidentally stumble onto it, so you don't have to worry about those sort of things. In terms of if you want to access the dark web, I will leave that to you and your own devices to find it out. I'm not about to help you.
Some computer club president you are. Okay, the next question is about ransomware. How do I defend against it? And even more interesting, if I get hit by ransomware, should I actually pay the ransom? So I had a couple of thoughts about this, and I would suggest that the best defense, and I can't believe these commercial operations that get hit by ransomware and end up paying tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And if you have a current backup of your complete system, but especially your user data, your personal data, and if you were to get hit by ransomware, what happens? Typically, they encrypt every drive that they can see on your computer. So you won't be able to access the files because they're encrypted, and that's what they want. They want you to pay money, and then in theory, they send you a decryption key, and you get your files back. Well, if you have a complete backup of the system, all you do is you wipe the computer completely clean. You can install the operating system, Windows typically, and all the applications programs from your original source, which is often is CDs or DVDs or downloading software from the internet, wherever you got it from in the first place. It's time consuming, but you can basically reload everything. The real problem is the user developed data, your personal files. You can't buy them, you can't download them from anywhere else because they're your files. You developed them, you modified them. So they're original, they don't exist anywhere else. So you have to have a backup of your user data. But you can restore that from that backup. However, let's suppose you have a disk image backup, and then the process becomes much easier. All you really do is you restore the most recent disk image back to the computer. You get the operating system, the applications, and the most and the data which is in that disk image snapshot. That all gets loaded back onto your computer. You run Windows Update to bring the operating system up to date. You run Sumo to find out which applications need to be updated, and you should have a recent data backup where you can overwrite the data from the disk image with the most recent set of data files, and then you should be basically back in business. So in my view, there's never any reason to pay crooks anything, but you have to have a functional backup and a functional recovery system. And Chris and I have spent a lot of time in the PC user group and indicating how you can effectively and efficiently make those kind of backups. So I don't know if anybody else has any, there's nothing in the chat, but anybody have any differing opinions about ransomware? Would you pay the bad guys?
I wouldn't pay the bad guy, but I'd like to provide it for commercial side of things. In regards to doing the backups, all very good advice, and there's nothing wrong with it whatsoever. I would say the best defense is to make sure that your system is up to date with the latest patches and any virus updates, whatever you choose to use, just to make sure that everything is fully up to date or up to date within 30 days, let's say, of when the update was released, and therefore gives it time for any bug fixes to be applied. The other side of this is that ransomware has changed perspective. They're no longer seem to be after you and I. They are after the corporations because that's where the money is. And unfortunately, even if you follow all the good advice, you can still run a program. One of the ones I'm getting bombarded with is malware infected Excel files. And when I say malware infected, it is literally a little script that runs a program that goes out to the control and command server and basically says, ha, we found a victim. Please download the stuff that's really going to make a difference. And then it will reach out through your network and try to gain further hooks into the system over time, hoping to find a good time to spring the message, lock all your systems, and force you into a situation where you have to pay the most bucks possible to get your system back and running because you have a critical meeting, sales objectives, or whatever. So, I mean, in the end, we all have to be careful. We all have to use wise trust in making sure that we don't open up any suspicious emails or smishing texts that come to us because they do find us. And though we're, you know, individuals are not as affected by ransomware, ransomware is still a big deal. And in fact, I hate to say that only because, you know, sometimes the computer press industry makes a bigger deal of something that isn't. But I will tell you that we, our IT professionals, are scared about one, only takes one individual to not be watching what they're doing that will allow for ransomware to get a hook into your overall network and cause that network to be owned by someone else expecting a big payoff for you to gain it back. And backups may not help you in that case. Even though I'm confident what the setup that I have is protecting me, a ransomware would still mean downtime that would affect our productivity. So I do recommend that on top of your backups and so forth, as stated, that you also take the time to make sure your system is fully up to date and making sure that your antivirus is up to date and watch out for suspicious emails, text, or any other electronic messaging out there.
And Micheline just put up a notice in the chat, which is a warning to people. And she got hit by ransom a number of years ago. It encrypted all my data drives, including my backup drive. And that's really why I said that ransomware will look for all of the drives on your system. And I think she probably added at the end, remember to disconnect your external drive after doing your backup so it can't be encrypted by ransomware. And that's really important that your main backup drive shouldn't be connected to your computer for exactly that reason.
I would teach on that front is that your main backup, I like it to be connected all the time because I like automated backups and I don't want to have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever to plug in my backup drive. However, that's where it becomes really important to have an off-site backup. So my off-site backup is disconnected and only gets connected about once a month. So if I get hit with ransomware and it encrypts my normal backup drive, I still have my off-site backup I can resort to, which may be a month old. But, you know, better than losing everything.
I would like to add the comment also is that even though you restore your system, they probably still have, they can still access it because they probably still have the password and username. So disconnect from the internet, restore, change the credential, and then reconnect.
Yeah, good point. Okay, so moving on to another operating system. If I can get the slide to change, there we are. Somebody with an Android phone and has problems with the file management program, always running out of memory and would like to know how to free up memory. Well, it so happens that the PC user group's meeting in October is all about managing your Android phone. And I happen to know the guy that's giving that presentation, and I recommend it. It should be a good thing.
He's a pretty trustworthy speaker, yeah.
Yeah, you never know. And he also has a blog about Linux, and you know that Android is really a variant of Linux, which is a variant of Unix. It's they're operating systems that have been around for a long time. And one of the things that you can do, I grabbed from my blog here, is to clear the cache. And one of the problems with Android is there are so many versions and so many different phones and so many OEMs that have modified Android that the instructions don't necessarily translate 100%. So you have to probably check on the web for your particular phone to find out how to do some of these things. But in my case, in a few years ago when I was running Android 7, basically you just went to settings and storage, internal shared storage, which is the phone's main memory, go to cache data, and then there's an option to clear the cache data. And that pops up a warning message, which is kind of scary. It says, oh, this will clear the cache data for all apps. And that's true, but I mean, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to create free disk space, get rid of the old cache and clear things out. So if you run an app and it needs some data from somewhere, it'll have to go and read it from the original source. It won't be able to go to the cache because the cache is now empty. And so it might slow things down slightly, but you won't really notice the difference. And you can actually clear up quite a bit of space that way. The other thing I do is I use a third-party file manager. And I've been using this one from ASUS. It's just called ASUS File Manager. Now, unfortunately, it seems to have been withdrawn from the Google Play Store. And I don't understand why, because it's an ASUS product, and but somebody's made it go away. It's still available on the web, so you can actually find it. And one of the neat features is it has a button down the bottom there, which is a storage analyzer. And if you click on that, it will break things out by categories of different files and also give you the sizes of folders. But the other thing to point out here is one of the space hogs are photographs. And if you've only got an 8-gig phone, this phone is an old phone. It's only got 8 gigs of main memory. And there's only about 5 gigs free. So if I start loading, okay, if I take lots and lots of photographs on my phone and they all end up in this internal storage, it eats up the available 4 gig or something fairly quickly. But note that on the right-hand side at the bottom there, I've got a 32-gigabyte micro SD card plugged in. So one of the things I can do, I can transfer my pictures. Tell the phone to store the pictures on that micro SD card, then I've got a fair amount of space. Anyway, if I look at the storage analyzer, then basically it breaks out the two drives, the main storage here at the top and the SD card down the bottom. And you can see I've got 76% used, and I've got about 5 gig and a gig free. But then over here, you can see the various folders. Well, you can see, first of all, the breakdown of, I don't have any music, for example, but I got 3.7 gig of other, which are typically system-type files, I think. But then on the, when you look at this, when you click on this button and look at the details, you can see that I've got almost 200 meg of, these are actually images, so they'll be photographs. So I could maybe do something about cleaning those things up to create some space. So you can use a file manager and look around the file system, at least what Android will show you as a regular user, and try to clean up files which are no longer used. Okay, so then the next question. Should I use a search engine other than Google to avoid being tracked as I move across the web? And Chris has some thoughts on search engines.
Yeah, I think that really there's two issues as I see it in terms of search engines actually tracking you. There are other tracking on, you know, that can go on and so forth. But for search engines themselves, I see two problems, tracking and confirmation bias. And so for actual, like, tracking where you're going and so forth, you have to realize that most search engines, they make more money for any ads that they can put out there if they're relevant to the person who's searching and if it causes a searcher to actually go to that particular site and potentially buy something. So they want to track where you go. So as an example, if I'm using a search engine and it tracks where I browse, so say I'm going to camera store websites and it'll track my searches. And so it might see that, oh, okay, Chris is searching for, or not Chris, this computer out there, the person on it, is searching for cameras and lens reviews and so forth. If it can do that, then all of a sudden, every website that I visit, the ads that I get that are put there by Google or whatever search engine I'm using, if they put up ads for camera stores, then it's more likely that I'm going to actually click on those and get sent to them, those websites, rather than if they showed me, you know, ads for canoes or something else. So in that terms, I think it's a good result. So you get relevant results and you get relevant ads that are sent to you. So if you search on the term vignette, if you're a photographer and you search for and you visit photography type sites, the results that you're going to get back on the search engine are more likely to be relevant to the darkening corners of images, which is one form of vignette. If you happen to be an interior decorator and you go to sites that are always talking about interior decorating and you're searching for terms that are relevant to that, when you search on the term vignette, you might actually get more sites that are detailing groupings of small objects, which is another context for vignette. So I think it's a really good thing that you get relevant results when you're searching. So would you rather see ads that are going to be relevant to what you like and what you search for and what you read about? Or would you rather see ads that are totally irrelevant to you? You're going to get ads no matter what. So I personally would rather see relevant ads. But there's a bad thing in all of this too, and that's confirmation bias. If you always searching things and the web search engine that you're using is watching where you go, they tend to give you results that are relevant to where you already visit. So an example of this might be that you search for the term anarchy. If you happen to be left-leaning, you might get a definition of the term. If you're a right-leaning person, you might get stuff about protests in Oregon or Fox News, you know, whereas a left-leaning person might not consider that to be anarchy. So what that can really lead to is that you'll get a narrower version of the world than if you go to a web or a search engine that doesn't track your movement. So when I don't care about confirmation bias, when I want it that I search for a vignette, I get about photography rather than interior decorating, I'm happy to use Google. If I'm worried about getting a narrow version of the world, then I might want to use a different search engine. So there are search engines that are specifically designed not to track you and not to give you confirmation bias. One of them is DuckDuckGo. Okay, there are others out there. You can search for it. You'll find it. If you actually go to DuckDuckGo and search for the terms search engines that don't track you, well, it's interesting. The first search is the result that you'll get back is DuckDuckGo. But the second result is 9 best anonymous search engines that don't track you like Google. I don't know. I didn't actually try it at Google to see what that same search term might turn up for me. But if you're trying to avoid confirmation bias and you're trying to avoid any of that sort of tracking from a search engine, then try DuckDuckGo or try one of the other ones that's available to you. Any other comments from other people in terms of are they concerned about search engines tracking you? What are your concerns and how you go about avoiding it? Anybody want to chime in?
I might add that Go is not a browser that you can. So how do you turn that off when you want to go from Chrome to?
No, it's not the browser. It's a search engine.
Okay, so how do you search DuckDuckGo from Chrome or what?
You can go to any browser and just go to DuckDuckGo.com. Okay. And do your searching from there.
Very good. Thank you.
All right, in some browsers, you can set up multiple browsers that you can change between, but that's a bit of a hassle, I would have thought.
Yeah. Linda, you unmuted yourself. Did you have something to add?
Just a little comment of what I find frustrating is, for instance, Chris is on my computer probably every weekend when he comes over and we're just doing things together or whatever. And if I've been looking for a gift for him, say it was a bicycle, then all of a sudden all these bicycle ads pop up and he knows what I'm going to get him for his birthday or whatever. Now, luckily, if it's something about cameras, he might think, oh, she's looking at that for herself. But I find that a little frustrating. But
you should bar me from using your normal browser and make me use one browser that you don't use.
Okay. All right. Another question about Android. How do I sync my Android phone to my computer so that you can use the computer to store things that they like to keep, but then be able to reload them to the phone if needed? So basically, how do you set up a data connection between a computer and an Android device, let's say? And one of the ways you can do that is by using a USB cable. And my example here, again, is from a few years ago when I had an Acer kind of 7-9-inch tablet. And it had a micro USB port, and I had it was micro USB to full USB. So that enabled me to connect the tablet to the PC. And this was running on the Windows, and when I plugged it in, it automatically recognized the tablet, which was an Android device, as a USB device. And as far as Windows was concerned, it looks like an external disk drive. And then it pops up in Windows Explorer, and you can simply drill down into the file system and transfer the files. And sure enough, I plug my current phone into Windows 10 and in File Explorer, and there it pops up as Moto G3. And I click on that to see what's there, and it says this folder is empty. And this is one of the problems I have with trying to use a cable with Windows. It's not clear what you need to do. And it's also not necessarily all that easy to find the fix. The fix is actually in the settings somewhere. And what you need to do is find a setting for USB preferences. And you can probably see in the screenshot here that my phone by default is set up for the USB to have no data transfer. So I can't transfer files to the phone, and that's why Windows sees the phone as being an empty drive, essentially. But if I click on the file transfer option, the radio button at the top, then suddenly Windows sees my two storage locations, the internal shared storage, which is the phone's main memory, and the SD card on the right-hand side there is my 32 gig micro SD card. And now I can click on any one of those, see the file structure, and happily upload or download files over the USB cable. Now, I find that a bit of a pain. So, because I have to dig out the cable and plug it in and make sure I've got the right USB connection, that kind of stuff. So I tend to use software. And the example here I've got is connecting Ubuntu, which is Linux, to an Android device. But exactly the same system works between Windows and Android. The software data cable basically just sets up an FTP connection, which is file transfer protocol. it sets up an FTP connection on the Android device, and then you can use FileZilla, which is a FTP client, to actually make the connection over a Wi-Fi router. So basically, I run the app, the software data cable app, on my phone. I click on the computer icon down at the bottom there, and that brings up a message which says, click on the blue arrow to connect the service. So I do that, and now it gives me an FTP IP address. So I've got 192.168.0.11 and port 8888. So now on my computer, so I've got the phone connect, I've got the phone ready to go with an FTP connection. On my computer, I run my FTP client and I set up a connection to my smartphone, and I give it that IP address and the port number, and I just say connect. And now FTP, the way FTP works is, on the left-hand side is my computer. So here's this PC and drive C and drive D, which is my data drive. And on the right-hand side is my phone. But the trick is that you can see there's a number of different connections there. And if you look, it's found a camera internal storage, one on an SD card. It's got some internal storage. It's got a thing called received. It's got a couple of things for SD cards, full access and read only. So the trick is to drill down into these and find out which is the one that you want to access in order to download files from the phone or upload files to the phone. And it turns out in this particular case, what I want to do is hit internal storage, which is where my screenshots are located. So if I open that folder and go down to pictures and screenshots, and all those screenshots I was just showing you of software data cable in action, they are these JPEG files on my phone. And in FileZilla, I just highlight them all, and I just drag them over and drop them into the window wherever I want to transfer them to on the computer. And clearly, you can do the same thing in reverse. If I double click on one of these files, it gets transferred over to the phone. So it's a really easy way to do it once you know how to navigate the various directory structures on the phone. And that, to me, that's always been trial and error. But what I do is I actually write myself a little help file so that I know which folder I want to access for different things. Okay, there's a couple of things in the chat window here. I find my fingers too big to hit the transfer button. Is there a way to use a mouse with the phone? I don't believe so. Anybody know whether you can do that or not? And my brother-in-law Bill is saying you can send data to Dropbox and then download it to the laptop. So that's another way, is to use a third-party cloud service and upload the files from the phone to, say, Dropbox, and then download the same files from Dropbox to your laptop. Okay, now we have a question for you all to think about. Google Chrome pauses sync every time I start the program. Any suggestions? I don't use Chrome, and I don't think Chris uses sync, so neither of us know the magic answer. But
well, actually, I do use the sync. It's a nice feature. So in Chrome, and I think Firefox does it as well, Edge browser does it or can do it. And if you're logged into the browser, then if you're logged in on another computer, it can synchronize various things such as your favorites, any preferences that you have on within the browser, extensions that you install in the browser can automatically get installed and activated on another computer where you're logged into the Chrome browser. or whatever browser it is. And it really works very, very nicely. The problem with this is that under normal circumstances, Chrome should log, once you tell it to log in, every time you load Chrome, it will log in using that same Google account that you set up to do the synchronization. The person who came up with this problem, every time she closes Chrome, when she restarts it, it says that syncing is paused and she has to go log into Chrome again using the settings in Chrome. And I couldn't figure out any reason why Chrome wasn't maintaining that log on status between Chrome sessions. So if anybody else has an idea about what would cause this and, more importantly, how to get around it, we can make sure that the person who asked this question gets the answer. And I hear deafening silence.
I will let them think about that and move on to
You can always jump in later on or throw it into the chat window if you have a solution to that particular problem.
So the next is a question from Stuart. Windows apparently can't decide whether his computer is a desktop or a mobile device, and every time it updates, all the options for dealing with public access points and hotspots get switched on, and the Wi-Fi gets switched on even if it's a, he says, a 10-pound box stuffed under a desk, in other words, his desktop. So what he's talking about is this thing right here under the settings menu, mobile hotspot. And you can see that mine is turned off, and I don't see the same problem, that when Windows updates this thing, mine always stays off as far as I know. I haven't changed it, and that's the way it's set. So I turned it off at one point and it stayed off. But clearly that's not been Stuart's experience. So anybody have any comments or solutions to that aspect? That's another thing people are going to think about.
I should interject, if I may, that it only seems to occur after things like cumulative updates, the big ones.
Feature updates or cumulative?
Feature updates, yeah, the massive ones.
Yeah.
And it just seems to assume that if you've got wireless connections, you must be on a mobile.
Yeah, I think that is the assumption that it's making. And
you don't have a battery, so.
Well, yeah. Yeah, who knows what they're keying on. But one thing that I've objected to over the years is that it seems when feature updates do come out, there's a real tendency of Microsoft to reset an awful lot of things that I think they have no business resetting. And,
exactly.
Yeah, I think you're running into that. So I guess there's two workarounds or two things that I think are worth doing. First is load the feedback hub on your computer and vociferously complain to Microsoft that they should not be making such changes at a feature update or at any time that you don't choose to actually do it. And the next thing would be to just put it on a checklist of things that need to be fixed whenever a feature update comes out, that you have to go through that checklist and just make sure that you undo everything that Microsoft foisted on you. But I really, really encourage you to go into the feedback hub and make your voice known.
Yeah. Well, twice a year I go through every setting on all our computers and try to check everything I remember to check.
Yeah.
And there's always new things. It's like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, true. Yeah.
But it's like, if it doesn't have a battery, why do they assume it's a mobile?
Yeah, I didn't think about it. I thought just, oh, yeah, they're keying on the Wi-Fi. But what you say makes ultimate sense, that they should look to battery as being a laptop as opposed to Wi-Fi, because a lot of desktops have Wi-Fi capabilities, but not a lot of desktops have batteries in them. So you're right. And so if you do get onto Feedback Hub, I would include mm-hmm. that in your feedback as well. Say, if you're keying on the fact that I've got Wi-Fi, you should key on the fact that I don't have a battery. Very good point.
You should leave the settings alone in the first place.
Yes, ideally. I suspect, I've accused them before and I didn't get any response from it, but I've accused them before of they think that periodically you need to be reminded of the wonderful things that they have available for you, and if they don't turn it on, you will never discover it, and so they're doing you a favor. They think they're doing you a favor by turning on some of these things so that you can discover their wonderful options or semi-options in their operating system.
Mm.
I don't think they took kindly when I accused them of that.
Oh, boy.
Okay, this is a question from Sue, I believe. A message that a draft photo book on a phone was about to expire. And you recall creating a photo album and doesn't know where it's stored. Is it in the cloud or is it on a hard drive? So a photo, and this is a good example of, you know, you don't know what's going on. So one of the things you can do here is just do a Google search, draft photo book about to expire, whatever the message is that you're seeing. And sure enough, something will pop up on the web. And there's the thing that I found was that, talking about editing draft photo books, there's something to do with Google Photos. So it doesn't necessarily mean it was the phone. It could be using a browser and accessing Google Photos and playing with digital photographs. So sure enough, if you load Gmail or something and look in the various features that Gmail and Google offers you, such as Google Docs and Google Drive, and you'll find that there is Google Photos. And if you click on Google Photos, then you get a menu down the left-hand side there, and you can see that one of the options is photo books, and that's where the photo books will be. I think what's happened there is when you have your camera and you're taking photographs, Google in its wisdom offers to help you by storing photographs to the cloud. And if you don't deny that access, then they will probably move things to Google Photos. And as you can see, in my case, it's ready to add some photos. So I clearly told them to go away and don't bother me. Anyway, cautionary tale. Here's another cautionary tale. This was Glenn. Saw a story on CTV News. An Ontario woman had her bank account frozen after accepting a $1,750 e-transfer for a diamond necklace which she'd sold. So she sold the necklace and accepted the cash as an e-transfer. And then her bank, 5 months later, locked up her account. So Glenn's saying, well, how can that be fraudulent? Because the banks are dealing bank to bank over secure systems and things. And why did it take 5 months before they decided it was a fraud? And what can we do to protect ourselves against this type of fraud? Well, again, it turns out that Lawrence Patterson has this presentation called Scam Avoidance and Trust, which he'll be giving at one of the library's Tech Cafe programs on November 23rd. So by all means, if you're interested in scams in depth, then sign in to register for Lawrence's presentation. It strikes me this particular e-transfer problem is quite unusual because the lady was receiving money. Normally, people complain about e-transfers when they're sending money and not getting the goods or somehow they're being scammed. And a lot of these e-transfer scams are because email accounts get hacked and e-transfers then get intercepted by the bad guys sitting on the end of the email and stealing the security passwords, or maybe even guessing the security password in some instances. And one of the examples of the latter was somebody who'd sent a security question to a friend as part of an e-transfer, and it said, "Who is my favorite Beatle?" Well, the problem with that is, as the Go Public decided, was there were really only four answers. There were four Beatles, and when they tested the Royal Bank's Interact system, they had four chances to answer the security question correctly. So I guess they got it right. There are lots of other e-transfer scams in various guises. A lot of them are phishing expeditions where you receive an email or a text message and it says that somebody sent you an e-transfer, but then you have to go log on and it looks like a bank website, but it's really not. It's one of these nefarious websites. And if you log on, then basically they've got your banking credentials and they'll hack into your account and steal whatever funds you have in the bank. So again, the club has a fraud watch page, lots of information, a lot of it from Lawrence about different kinds of scams and some of the specific scams that members have received by email and text. There's a whole bunch of red flags that show you how they were detected and not acted upon. Now, the good news was that the lady with the diamond necklace did actually get her money back. The bank released her bank account. But there was some other guy who was selling antique training shoes, including Jordan Airs. He'd sold them for $1,000 and got his money by e-transfer. And then again, the bank decided it was a fraudulent money transfer and clawed it back. And in one of the stories, there was a quote from Interact, and it basically says, "Customers should always be vigilant when they're transacting online and should ensure that they're only transacting with trusted websites, vendors, and people." Now, isn't that terribly helpful? So be wary, be warned. Okay, I think this might be the final question, but it's in two parts. My neighbor's kid is locked out from her Outlook account. I guess that's email. The problem is her original cell phone is discontinued, so it's no longer valid. And so I guess that means you don't get the recovery email issue. She attempted too many times with a different email account, which failed. Now, what can she do to recover the account? And then the second part of that was that since that Outlook account is locked, and I think she must use it for the computer, nobody can now sign into the computer. So is there any way to get around this to be able to use the computer? And I think maybe Bernie has some thoughts on this. Or Chris does.
Bernie, do you want to jump in and tell the sad saga of what happened to you?
Okay. Actually, the first thing that happened is when I opened up my cell phone, I had a note on it that said that all your emails are currently being forwarded to bdlipsky@yahoo.com. And Lipsky is misspelled with two I's. And it says, disable forwarding. Well, my problem was I didn't have the faintest idea how to disable it. Then I tried to send a message just to see if it worked. And when I went to send message, a reminder came up and said that you will not receive replies to this email. And I mentioned my name, bdlipsky@voices.com. They will be sent to bdlipsky@yahoo.com. Now I was completely stumped, didn't know where to go. So I called Rogers, since they are my supplier. And I have to admit, they were good. I spent a lot of time on the phone. They reset my password, eliminated the fake account, or well, probably wasn't fake, it was somebody else's account, and they got me running again. So I have to give all the kudos to Rogers. For once, they helped. Took me a long time, but the problem was solved. They changed my, I could reset my password and got running again. But it was funny. My cell phone was gone. So was my laptop. And so was my desktop. I couldn't use either one for email. And I use Outlook, by the way. So I had to reset everything.
Yeah, well, you would have had to reset all of those because they changed your password on there. So you'd have to change the account settings in Outlook on those computers, which makes sense. I think that this is one of the interesting things about this tale is that I used to always tell people that you shouldn't use, like, if you're with Rogers, they give you an email address, you know, firstname.lastname or whatever at rogers.com. Or if you're with Simpatico, it'll be at simpatico.ca. And I used to tell people all the time, don't use that address because it really ties you to that particular internet service provider. There's nothing more painful, I think, than having to, after years of using a given email address, of changing to something else. And so I always told people, why not get a free account at Yahoo or at Outlook.com or Gmail, one of the big ones that's out there. They're going to be around as long as your internet service provider is, for sure, and it gives you portability. But in this instance that Bernard had this problem, if he had been, if the account had not been Rogers.com but rather had been Gmail.com, the likelihood that he could have called somebody at Gmail and gotten them to, you know, discontinue the forwarding and change his password on his account and anything like that is pretty much zero. So that's something, a value that I had never really considered of sticking with your internet service provider for the email provision. So in this case, it actually, you're a lot better off not being on Outlook.com or Gmail.com or whatever. In this particular instance, people chime in if you've got an idea, but I think this person is cooked. Now, the only account that they had on their computer to log on to the computer was a Microsoft account, which happened to be the Outlook email address. They can't get into that, so they can't log on to the computer. They have no other account on the computer, so that they can't sign in using some other account. And the recovery means that could have been set up is no longer available, or the phone is no longer available. So I don't see any way that this person is going to be able to get back onto their computer or back into their Outlook email address. As I say, if anybody's got an idea, please jump into the chat or unmute yourself and chime in. But I don't see any way that they're going to be able to get back in working order with that. Any ideas? This goes back a little bit to a recommendation I had a couple of Q&As ago, where always make sure that you do have multiple administrator-level accounts on your computer, at least one extra one. That is a local account, not a Microsoft account. And so if you have a problem, you're always able to log on using that other account and use it to fix problems such as this. But a little bit difficult to do after the horse has left the barn. It's kind of difficult.
Okay, do we have any other questions, although we're just about out of time?
Yeah, we could
I guess there aren't seen any other questions.
There is a question on how do you set up an offsite administrator account. I could demo that really quickly if you want. Let me just load settings. Let me do a share screen and go to my settings. So you're seeing my settings window now?
Yes, me.
Okay. So if you go into accounts right there and then go into family and other users and you want to add someone else to this PC. And I'm going to run through this pretty quickly so you can just follow along with the audio later on if you want. And now who's going to use this PC? Well, this is interesting. They used to automatically assume that you were going to use a Microsoft account. It looks now that, for some reason, it's just actually not going to do that. Oh, it might be. Let me just actually close this. Couldn't connect to your Microsoft family now. That's because I'm not using a Microsoft account. Sometimes in the dialog box you'll have is, I don't have the person's email address. And it will then let you continue on, and you'll get a screen like this where it's a local account. So just get to a point where you're not being prompted for an email address or anything that looks like an email address. And so in this case here, anything that I enter in will be a local account. Okay. But I'm not exactly sure why I didn't get that other prompt going back a screen. Let me try going into here just very quickly again, just to make sure. Accounts, family and other users. Oh, now I'm no longer getting that. Add someone else. There we go. Okay, for some reason now I'm getting it. So how will this person sign in? Email address or phone? Don't do it. You go to, I don't have this person's sign-in information, and then you get, I want to add a user without a Microsoft account. That will be a totally local account. Does that answer your question, B?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay.
I had no idea even what a local account meant. Sorry.
Yeah, Microsoft wants you to use what's known as a Microsoft account, which is basically just any email address. And there are some benefits to using that, such as it can sign you in automatically into the store and your Outlook account for email and things like that. But I think for disaster recovery purposes, you definitely don't want it associated with anything that requires internet access to actually log in. So having a local account, nothing actually leaves the computer for the authorization portion.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
And the other thing about local accounts or regular accounts is that you don't have administrative permissions to do something. So it's a bit more secure that way. Okay, so I guess we're about out of time. We should probably wrap things up.
Okay.
So let me just remind you again, the club meeting is on the 14th, managing your phone. We have the next Tech Cafe that we're running, the OPC user group, is on November the 23rd, Lawrence's SCAM presentation. And our next Q&A session will be next Wednesday, October the 7th. And as usual, send your questions and answers and topics that you want to share with people to our suggestion box at opcug.ca email address. So thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed it. And goodbye till next week.
Thanks very much, folks. See you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.